Okay, it's a pleasure to be here. And I'm going to talk today about work I've done with three graduate students, Monica Guica, Tom Hartman. Monica's in Paris, Tom's still at Harvard. And Wei Song, who is not my student, but Miao Li's student, and is in Beijing now. And what we have done is we've argued that the extreme Kerr black holes have a dual description as a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And furthermore, we've done some calculations, in particular the entropy of extreme Kerr, which have given evidence for that argument. Now, I believe this is the first time that, of course, we're used to holographic dualities coming up in string theory, but I believe this is the first time that that there's been an argument that applies to some physical object that we observe in our universe. Of course, there are arguments going the other way of sort of condensed matter systems that have some dual descriptions as string theory, but here I'm actually arguing that there's regions of our universe which are well described, which should be well described by conformal field theory. Now, so just to emphasize that point that these things are observed in the sky, I've got a picture here of GRS, an artist's rendition. but there are, of course, plenty of pictures. There's, in fact, an enormous amount of data on this, of GRS 1915 plus 105. And the black hole, obviously, is in the middle here. And very conveniently, it's in a binary system. The GRS 1915, they don't know the mass so well, but it's about 10 solar masses. And very conveniently, it's in a binary system with a star which feeds matter into the black hole. The matter goes into an accretion disk. And as it goes in, of course, it has to lose energy, and that energy comes off in the form of thermal radiation, and there have been really spectacularly accurate measurements.
Thermal radiation?
Yes. Because it's hot. It's a hot plasma. And so it spirals in, though there is actually a lot of discussion, which perhaps some of the methods that I'm describing today can aid, of exactly how there's some sort of turbulence which turns into a flow here, and exactly how that happens. But very basic considerations of energy conservation and so on tell you what the spectrum is. Now, what happens is that, so this GRS 1915, they don't know, they only have a lower bound. As you probably know, there's a maximal limit that a maximal rotation that a black hole can have. And that basically you can think of that as the horizon of the black hole cannot spin around any faster than the speed of light. And that gives this bound that J over GM squared is less than one. And for GRS 1915, they don't know exactly what it is, but there's a lower bound of this of 0.98. So this thing is very, very near extreme. And in fact, there's some kind of instability for black holes surrounded by accretion disks, oddly, to increase their angular moment, to increase this this ratio. So very highly rotating black holes we expect to see more of them. So what happens here is that there's something called the innermost stable circular orbit, or the ISCO, and the stuff goes around in the accretion disk and radiates, and once it crosses, it hits the ISCO, it just plunges into the black hole. And it turns out that for Schwarzschild, the ISCO is at R equals 3m, but for extreme Kerr, it's at R equals m. So it touches the horizon when at the extreme limit, which is why, and the nature, so then the radiation that comes out has a lot of redshift, which is why they're able to measure this quantity. Fortunately for us, it's exactly the quantity. It's exactly the
distance out the ISCO, even in the extreme Kerr?
Sorry?
Isn't it a finite distance, proper distance? It's still, it doesn't merge with the horizon. Isn't it a finite distance from the horizon?
Yeah, that's a subtle thing. It's at R equals M.
Right, because it's R doesn't change rapidly.
It's at R equals M, but it's still a proper distance which can be calculated. It's at R equals M, but the coordinates, actually, this is actually a much more complicated question than you might imagine. The limit from near extreme to extreme Kerr is an extremely subtle thing, and it depends on how you take the limit, and in some ways of taking the limit, the ISCO goes to the proper distance along a space like along a line of constant T is some calculable function which there's weird numbers like root two log three, which is bigger than M.
Anyway, you're only at 98%, right? So, extremality.
Right, or more. That's the lower bound.
Experimental. Well, there's an old argument to Kip Thorne, right, that you wouldn't expect to find black holes in nature with any momentum bigger than 98%, having to do with the details of the accumulation of angular momentum.
Yeah, I've never understood that argument. I'm not sure if this has hit that limit yet, though. I think that's a very, very close to extreme limit.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically just cosmic censorship. You can't overspin a black hole, and so black holes must repel things that would try to overspin it as they approach extreme.
Yeah, but that argument still allows you to get to 0.9999999. But there's actually some Thorne has some limit which involves knowing the matter content of the universe. It's not something that you can derive just from pure GR, and it has to do something with backspin.
Black hole because it's inheriting angular momentum, right? But as the stuff goes faster, it also radiates in the forward direction, right?
Yeah.
Which slows it down. So the balance between these two occurs at 98%, as I remember.
Well, I don't think that can be quite right because these people are still trying to push it up, and they're well aware of this Thorne. I discussed exactly this point with Narayan, and their bound is not at the Thorne limit yet.
Well, Thorne could be wrong.
Thorne could be wrong, but nobody seems to think so.
But also, the experimental error bars on that are bigger than 2%. So
no.
No.
They aren't bigger than 2%. This is what they're quoting. 0.98.
I know, but nobody else believes that.
Okay. So
you said to yourself, they don't know the mass out exactly.
Because that's the point is that you can measure J over M squared much more accurately than you can measure the mass.
Could we skip this observational stuff? This is a string theory seminar.
But it is not. In fact, it is not a string theory seminar. No string theory in my talk.
Okay, thank you. Excuse me.
Where was I here? Okay, so what we're interested in is there's some kind of fixed point here. In the extreme case, we're going to idealize the extreme case, and of course there'd be at least 2% corrections if you want to apply it to GRS 1915. But there's a near horizon region, which Gary and Jim Bardeen discovered maybe 10 years ago, and that's where the CFT, that's where I'm going to argue that the CFT lives.
That's the black region.
You know, I think that this is probably the plunge region. I'm not sure exactly where, but yeah. Now, fortunately for us, NASA has actually made a video of the near horizon limit. No, this is a video of, oh, come on. Oh, here we go. Okay, view. Full screen. No. Ah. Okay.
There is no sound?
There is sound. No, wait a second.
So here it is,
zooming in on the near, through this accretion disk, through the ISCO, and there we have it, bang, the near horizon limit. And in fact, there is sound. Sound's my computer, I'm not going to bother to fix it. They took the X-rays that are coming out, and they, this guy at MIT took the X-rays and shifted the frequency or something and actually made a sound. So that video has sound. Look it up on the web. Okay, that's it for computers. So maybe we could lift the screen. Somebody could lift the screen. Okay. So I already gave away that this wasn't a string theory talk. So let me talk a little bit about the setting for this. Which is, okay, so we all know that one of the great puzzles of modern physics is to understand the relationship between thermodynamics and black holes, and that a complete understanding of that will lead to an entire new view of the universe. Now, so this problem can be focused, or at least I'd like to focus it on the problem of giving a microscopic accounting of the Bekenstein-Hawking area law for the entropy. And that's nice because it's a number and you know when you get the number right. Now, about 10 years ago, string theory was used to for certain five-dimensional supersymmetric black holes to do this, and string theory and D-brains and lots of mathematics, and it was a rather long calculation and seemed to rely heavily. So we have a black, is there any real pieces of chalk here? Macroscopic rather than microscopic. So the black hole puzzle. And then about 10 years ago, string theory explained it. And for certain five-dimension supersymmetric black holes, and it seemed as if the calculation depended on, we had to wait for Joe to discover D-brains, and we had to know about moduli. It seemed like it depended on every last detail of string theory, and that the success could therefore be viewed as evidence in favor of string theory. But then a couple years later, I showed that in fact it's true the same explanation, in other words, we explained it by constructing the dual conformal field theory, The same explanation would have to work for any theory. So it's good for any theory which contains these black holes as solutions, and which contains the given black holes, and has a consistent ultraviolet completion and is unitary. And that argument was just made really relying only on general properties of the diffeomorphism group. So you might turn around and say, you might say that, okay, that this wasn't really a success of string theory. But I wouldn't say it that way. I would say it a different way. Well, I think what this argument shows is that any consistent ultraviolet completion of gravity must have an awful lot, must look an awful lot like string theory, and close enough that we would probably claim that it was string theory, whatever it is. Whatever string theory is, yeah. So, but still, since so string theory gave us some kind of conceptual understanding, one would like to apply it to the black holes we actually, some black holes we actually observed, which what I'll talk about today. So let me give briefly give an analogy. In the 19th century, Boltzmann used the then controversial theory of molecules to give a statistical derivation of the laws of thermodynamics. Now, in a theory of continuous fluids or continuous gases without molecules, thermodynamics has an ultraviolet problem because there are infinite number of degrees of freedom, and if you put a continuous fluid in contact with a heat bath, you'd have all the energy would run away into the ultraviolet. So Boltzmann used the theory of molecules to provide a cutoff and do the derive thermodynamics from statistical mechanics. So the same thing should be true for understanding black hole thermodynamics. In other words, it didn't seem right that we should need all the details of string theory because the area law is so universal. It didn't seem right that we should need all the details of string theory in order to understand the entropy, and that was indeed what was found for these black holes later. So another way of saying it is what Vafa and I did was sort of like first computing the periodic table and then computing the thermodynamics of gases. You don't need the whole periodic table to get thermodynamics, and you don't need string theory to get the area law. Okay, so so that's the setting. So let me start now. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to apply this kind of logic. I'm basically going to follow the same kind of logic that I followed here, and it's really exactly the same logic. But it turns out to be substantially more convoluted, and the mathematics turns out to be substantially more subtle. Okay, so I'm going to start by just reviewing a little bit about Kerr. So the line element for extreme Kerr.
So, before you go on, can I just, yeah. Does new quantum gravity count as a consistent ultraviolet contribution of gravity?
Well, loop quantum gravity certainly so far doesn't count as a consistent ultraviolet completion of quantum. I mean,
what is it missing?
They can't compute a one loop scattering amplitude. If you have a cutoff, you can compute a one. They can't compute anything. However,
the regularization.
They can't.
Thank you. Okay, that's enough. That's what he said.
Yeah, and also in a way, I would say that this is kind of evidence against loop quantum gravity, because today there's no evidence of any kind of holographic structure in loop quantum gravity. And what I'm going to argue is that Kerr is a holographic system. But nevertheless, I would say that if they do succeed someday in making sense of loop quantum gravity, which is not ruled out in principle, then I believe that it will, that this scenario will have to be realized within it. Okay. So the metric, so let me define rho squared is equal to r hat squared, and I'm putting hats on things because I'm going to do a scaling limit, is equal to r hat squared plus j cosine squared theta, and I'm going to set g equal to h bar equal to 1. And then I can write the line element as r minus m squared. The general Kerr is not a whole lot more complicated, but I'm not going to use it, so there's already enough formula here. So that'd be d hat minus m sine squared theta d phi hat squared plus sine squared theta over rho squared r hat squared plus j d phi hat minus m dt hat all squared plus rho squared over r minus m squared dr hat squared plus rho squared d theta squared. Okay, that's the famous Kerr metric, one of the great discoveries in mathematical physics, this highly non-trivial solution of Einstein's equations. They should all be hatted.
Why the hat?
Because I'm reserving the unhat for a preferred variable I'm going to introduce in a moment. And now this has this. There's an angular velocity of the horizon, which is equal to 1 over 2. Can people see this far down? Really? Okay. 1 over 2m. And interestingly, the entropy, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is, of course, the area over 4, is just equal to 2 pi j. And if I were momentarily to restore the h bars, it would be 2 pi. So it's 2 pi times the number of fundamental units of angular momentum. Now, this, of course, makes Kerr, extreme Kerr, very interesting because, you know, in trying to go from supersymmetric objects to non-supersymmetric objects, it's kind of an intermediate step. The temperature is zero, so it's not like studying Schwarzschild where it sort of is decaying before your eyes. The temperature is zero, though oddly it still decays. But nevertheless, there's something to understand because the entropy is non-zero. Okay, so now, all right, that's the lightning review of Kerr. Any questions about Kerr? Okay, so now I'm gonna, following Bardeen and Horowitz, I'm gonna show that this geometry has a very interesting near horizon region. I should have written that on the board. Oh, I did over there. J equals m squared. Yeah.
Can you see someplace in the metric what goes wrong?
What goes wrong when you could see from this that the horizon is moving at the speed of light. And you could see that if you made J greater than M, it would be going faster than the speed of light.
The area depends only on J, not on M?
Well, J is equal to M squared. There's a more complicated formula, which we also wish to explain, the more complicated formula, but for now we're just doing the simplest thing.
And earlier you remarked that you have to take the limit carefully, and so is there a, do you always get this line element no matter how you take the limit?
No, you could take the limit in a way that would give you the next geometry that I'm about to describe, I suppose. So now we introduce new variables, the unhadded variables, dimensionless unhadded variables. Now, you see, and lambda is our scaling variable. So, see, here we're doing nothing. We're just doing a coordinate transformation. But you see that if we're going to take lambda to 0 and keep r fixed, then we're pushing r hat to m. So this is a near horizon limit. And you find that the line element becomes, interestingly, the angular momentum just sits out as an overall scale factor to J omega squared, which I'll define omega squared in a moment, and then minus R squared dt squared plus the R squared over R squared plus lambda squared d phi plus R dt squared, where omega squared is equal to 1 plus cosine squared theta over 2, and lambda, with just definition, is equal to 2 sine theta over 1 plus cosine squared theta.
Andy?
Yes.
There's one variable missing.
You forgot the theta. Now, why do I always forget? I always forget the theta. I did that. Okay. Okay. So, all right. So it turns out. So let me just. Now, interestingly, the symmetry here is now SL2R. Times U1, whereas before we just had U1 times U1. And so let's try to understand this. It turns out that there's a value of theta for which lambda squared is equal to 1. Let's look at the sort of cone of where lambda squared is equal to 1. Then you may recognize this, TR and d phi, those of you who've played with ADS3 may recognize that as the ADS3 geometry. Moreover, if you go to any other value of theta, it's a close cousin of ADS3 called warped ADS3, which has the same relation to ADS3 that the squashed 3 sphere has to the ordinary 3 sphere. So every sort of cone of fixed theta is a warped anti-de-Sitter space, and so that of course was an immediate hint that this geometry should have something to do with conformal field theory. Now, I haven't written this these are not global coordinates on the neck geometry, but it's not too hard to transform this to find a global coordinate system, and you can see it in Gary's paper. Rho is R.
Oh.
Rho is basically R. So, you know, I included all that.
But by the way, the scaling with J is also a property of Kerr, even if you don't, you know, take this funny near horizon limit. I mean, everything scales that way.
Is that right?
It just doesn't look that way in the ordinary coordinates. Yeah, it's just the scaling variance of general relativity. Multiply, you know, a solution by
and
then you get a solution.
Okay. So, all right. So now we have this geometry, and now we have a homework problem. And the homework problem is to, and so that's what I'm going to talk about next. The homework problem is to understand how to define quantum gravity on a space like this. In other words, what are the conserved quantities? What kind of boundary conditions should we impose? And what is the symmetry group, and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of machinery of this, of course, starting all the way back to ADM. But we found many people have worked on it. But I think the most extensive and complete analysis of these general kinds of spaces is done by the Belgian group. And in fact, we learned it from Jeffrey Compare's thesis, wherever he is here. Yeah, we got it out of Jeffrey's thesis. But anyway, there's been a lot of work on this, and so now a homework problem: how do you define quantum gravity on a space like this? What are the conserved quantities and the symmetry groups? Well, the first thing you have to do is to find so. This boundary is rather peculiar, and even the warped ADSs are peculiar, and it has not been much discussion of it, and there's still many things I don't understand about even warped ADS, but there are some things that we have understood. So the first thing you do is you want to find what's called the asymptotic symmetry group, or the ASG. And how do you do that? Well, you choose some boundary conditions. Then you define the allowed diffeos as all diffeomorphisms which preserve your boundary condition. Then you try to construct the generators. And here you can get into trouble if you made the wrong choice in the beginning. And the trouble that you get into is that the generators may be ill-defined. So for example, if we decided to quantize gravity in four dimensions with saying that the metric goes like 1 over log r, we'd find that the energy and the expressions for the energy and momentum were divergent, and it wouldn't make any sense. So you have to find boundary conditions for which these generators are finite. And this procedure is a little tricky because there's sort of a closed loop here, because you don't know what the allowed diffeos are so you don't know which generators you're supposed to construct before you know what the allowed diffeos are, and those depend on the boundary conditions. So it's not, in general, there can be, all right, so the generators must be finite. I think they're automatically closed. But there's a lot of subtle things that can happen here. this whole story is very simple in 3+1 dimensions, but in some applications, like for example, it's been used in the Godel universe, you know, in some applications it gets really very, very tricky. And this was one of them. And then we found, we considered all possible boundary conditions where the components of the metric approach this the next geometry asymptotically, like some power of R. And there, in that class of boundary conditions, there's only one consistent choice, and it's in this sense. You can make the other problem you could have in four dimensions. You could say, okay, I don't want my generators to blow up. Let's make the metric fall off like 1 over R squared. Then you don't have any problem with generators blowing up, but then your theory becomes trivial. Generally, there's a very narrow window. And it's known for ADS3, Brown and Hanau, that very narrow window, that there is a very narrow window, and that narrow window gives you the conformal group, two copies of the conformal group. Okay, the generators must be finite. And there's one other thing that we did. I'm sorry, we didn't analyze everything that went like a power of R. We also wanted to demand that the energy be above, that m squared equals j, because we just wanted to consider the extreme case. There's a more difficult problem where you allow, that's the study of the, that's the problem that you need to tackle to compute the near extreme entropy. But we were just trying to do the simplest thing first.
So normally you would choose boundary conditions, as you say, in which the generators are non-zero and finite, and then just sort of look for those solutions which happen to satisfy this m squared equals j. Are you saying the boundary conditions themselves might change? You know, that the boundary conditions depend on having m squared equals j, and that when you go away from extremality, you might have to modify the whole boundary conditions and definition of the asymptote and the generators?
Those are some of the charges, right? And
so you have fixed boundary conditions, you have fixed definition of charges, and then you just choose to look at the subset which satisfies this particular. And that's the way it usually goes. But it sounded like you were saying something stronger, that you might have to change your whole boundary condition.
Well, I don't know of a consistent set of boundary conditions in this problem. I'm not saying I don't think there is one, but I don't know of a consistent set of boundary conditions that allows m squared greater than j. So you see, because these generators, I believe that the generators will become infinite if we...
No one for j equals
zero. Sorry?
You don't know for j equals zero?
J equals zero, that's pretty singular. Oh, well, but this geometry is just not relevant at J equals zero. It's Rindler space. So we tried to, this is clearly the next thing to try to understand, right? In fact, that's what we're working on now. But, you know, I don't understand it now, and we just wanted to understand the simplest thing first, which was the 2πj. Okay, so we just said, okay, we're not going to try to solve this problem right now.
Can you clarify one thing?
Yeah.
This condition m squared equals j, is it a consequence of the finiteness of the charges, or a consequence of the integrability of the charges?
It's just a boundary condition. It's just a boundary condition. We're only considering metrics which have m squared equals j.
I mean, you don't get an infinite throat otherwise. Does that make a big difference or something?
You don't get an infinite throat. And there's something, you know, there's something very puzzling that we don't understand, which is in ADS3, we had the BTZ, which is near ADS3. And we don't understand the analog of BTZ here. We don't know how to think about near extreme. But, you know, really, it's going to take me a lot of time to explain what I do understand. Explaining what I don't understand is...
I still want to ask, but when you say you don't understand M squared on equal J, is it finite differences or differences in scale as one over lambda? I mean, the excited states within the near horizon symmetry theory, we have larger M squared, but the difference in scale is one over lambda. And you take lambda away.
Right, right.
Okay, so those are included, or even those are not included?
Those are not included.
Even those are not included.
Those are not included. They're not included in the talk today. We have some partial results on that. Okay. So then you have allowed diffeos, and then you have something called trivial diffeos. And the trivial diffeos, see, these generators of a local symmetry always have the property that they have a bulk part. So by the generators, so we're doing classical analysis here. What I mean is some expression, some function of the fields that generates via Dirac brackets the desired symmetry transformation. And they always have the form of a bulk integral, which vanishes when the constraints are imposed, and a boundary integral, like the boundary ADM expression for the energy or the momentum or the angular momentum. And a trivial diffeo is one for which the generator is weakly equal to zero. That is, there's no boundary term. And when the constraints are imposed, it vanishes. So then the asymptotic symmetry group is defined as the allowed diffeos modulo the trivial diffeos. And this is something simple for 3 plus 1 gravity, the Poincaré group. For ADS3, it's generated by two Virasoro algebras. And we're going to see here that it's generated by one Virasoro. Okay. Now, so, I'm trying to decide how much detail to give, and I'm almost out of time. Something like that. Okay, so what we found is, so we imposed some boundary conditions, which you can see in our paper, you know, the form, you know, H theta phi goes like is order 1 over R and so on. Okay, so there's some list that was constrained by this needing to be a consistent procedure here. And we found that the allowed diffeos were epsilon of phi d phi minus R d epsilon d phi dr plus trivial. And now if we write epsilon of phi equals e to the in phi and zeta n equals zeta of epsilon n, the Lie bracket algebra of these diffeomorphisms is zeta. It's a centerless Virasoro algebra. Okay. So we've seen that now that the asymptotic symmetry group is equal to is generated by one copy of the Virasoro algebra, but there's something else we want to do, which is to compute the central charge. Now the generators, which I'll call Q of sub zeta m, Q sub zeta n, their Lie bracket algebra, their Dirac bracket algebra, sorry, has to be equal to the Lie bracket algebra by construction. Has to be equal to the Lie bracket algebra up to a possible central term. Now, so it's equal to Q of theta m theta n plus a central term, which is really a rather complicated expression, and I'm not even going to write it down. You can find it in Jeffrey's thesis. Barnack and Brandt, Lie zeta n, where this is the background metric, g bar. Okay, and so just to, you know, this k, you know, just to give you an idea what it looks like, you know, k of zeta of some perturbation h and some metric g starts off like dx alpha dx, it's a two form, dx beta minus a quarter epsilon wedge, epsilon alpha beta mu nu, and then you take zeta nu d mu acting on the trace of h and minus zeta nu d sigma h mu sigma, and basically every possible term that is allowed by the symmetries appears in here, and it's some long expression. Yes?
So this is a general formula which works for all spacetimes and any boundary condition. And, I mean, would this give this sort of regular three-dimensional result of...
Why these people went to all this trouble to derive formulas that were applicable in absolutely every circumstances is beyond me, but we were extremely grateful to discover that they had done so.
Central expansion vanishes for n m equals 0 plus or minus 1?
Yeah.
But surely not every spacetime has a Virasoro algebra.
No. So this thing is almost always zero, which is why you would wonder why it was worked out in such great detail. But we were very happy. And actually, many of the formalisms, like the Brown-York formalism, many of the formalisms, you know, kind of miss important subtleties and aren't fully consistent in the. Most formalisms are developed to handle things that are already known. It's very rare that somebody develops a formalism to handle something that comes in the future, but that's what happened here. Okay, so we computed this, and we found that the central charge. Let me write this over here because it's important. So the central charge works out to be 12J, and let me put back in the H bar.
That formula for this metric is, this background is n by n squared minus 1.
Yeah. Well, let's see. This doesn't automatically give you the shift in L0, so it might come out in a different form. Okay. Now, obviously, what I want to do is to use the Cardy formula, and in fact, I'm going to use it in the form S is equal to pi squared C T over 3. I'm going to use the temperature version of it, so I don't have to worry about the zero of L0. And I want to use that to get this formula. But there's a little problem here, because I've already told you that, well, I didn't write it, that the Hawking temperature is equal to zero. But the Hawking temperature isn't the temperature we would want to use here. We would want to use the temperature which is conjugate to the conserved quantity, which is the zero mode of our Virasoro algebra, which is the angular momentum. And Hawking temperature is conjugate to the energy. Now, there are two conserved quantities in Kerr. There's of course the energy, and there's the angular momentum, and it's natural to form quantities which are, you know, things can be moving left clockwise and right clockwise. So there's left movers and right movers in this story, and there's a left temperature and a right temperature. So we can figure out what there are different ways of doing this, but the way we did it was we looked at the vacuum for extreme Kerr, the vacuum state for extreme Kerr, which was just a regular scalar field, which was constructed by Frolov and Thorne some decades ago. And as you would expect, it's a density matrix. It's the analog. It becomes the Hartle-Hawking vacuum. They did it for general angular momentum. It becomes the Hartle-Hawking matrix, Hartle-Hawking vacuum when you go to Schwarzschild. And of course, we know that the Hartle-Hawking vacuum for Schwarzschild is a density matrix at a temperature given by the Hawking temperature. But here, there's when you turn on the angular momentum, it's more complicated because you're introducing a potential for other thermodynamic quantities. And basically, what you get is the density matrix omega, that's the energy, minus the angular momentum m times the angular velocity omega h, which acts like an angular potential, divided by the Hawking temperature. So now, if you take the extremal limit of this formula, you find that the vacuum is a density matrix of the form, let's see, how am I going to write this? Let me write n left equals m, and n right equals 1 over lambda to omega minus m, to m omega minus m. And then this becomes equal to e to the minus n left over t left minus n right over t right. All I've done is rewrite things here in terms of left movers and right movers. And add extremality, t right is going to zero, so there are no right movers excited. The right sector is in the ground state. And t left goes to 1 over 2 pi. And so now we just have some short algebra, which is a lot of fun, so I always redo it. And you find that the entropy is equal to pi squared over 3 times the central charge. What did I do? 12J times the temperature, which is 1 over 2 pi, which is equal to 2 pi j. So, which is equal, of course, to the, so this is the microscopic entropy, and this is the macroscopic Bekenstein-Hawking area entropy law. So, we had an a priori argument that, that Kerr should be dual to a CFT. There were numbers there, in particular the central charge, and those numbers worked out, central charge and the temperature, and those numbers worked out exactly to give us the entropy of extreme Kerr. And so our conjecture then is that extreme Kerr is holographically dual to the chiral half of a conformal field theory with this central charge. Now, so where do we go from there? Well, first of all, there are many generalizations of this that have already been worked out. There have been a number of papers on this. You can look at Kerr ADS. You can add charges. You can go to higher dimensions. You can add angular momentum in different planes, and so on and so forth. And then there are not just one number, but there are many numbers and functions and so on. And in every case, it doesn't look quite so trivial. And in every case, it all matches exactly. Now, what we're now trying to do, Tom and Wei and I, is to, there's a huge amount of work that was done in the early 70s by Press and Tilkowski, in which, a sort of real mathematical tour de force, in which they basically exactly solved the problem of scattering off of a Kerr black hole. And the answers take up pages with gamma functions and so on and so forth. And all that, in particular, there's some very interesting super radiant scattering, and we can certainly see that there is some. We can see some super radiant. So we're trying to now compute the super radiant scattering, and we've got it working in several limits. And there's another limit that we don't have yet, but it's looking like. We're optimistic that it's going to work. And then finally, of course, the most interesting thing would be if there were something interesting about some behavior of these black holes that we could explain qualitatively using these methods. Now, first of all, the actual computation. And this ISCO and is this the physics that they're observing is well within the near horizon region. So these methods should be applicable. The state of the art is all these just to calculate this temperature distribution and so on requires massive numerical calculations, and there's some rather complicated story where you have magnetically charged particles and there's some turbulence and so on, and it goes in, and maybe some order can be found in that. And even more interesting is that this. If you saw that picture, you saw these spouts coming up, the jets, and that also should somehow be part of this story. And but not only are there these jets, but apparently like once a week, GRS 1915 gets up and does a jig. It suddenly once a week it'll get up and it'll spout for. It'll spout at 20-second intervals for about large amounts of stuff, and then it will shut off after a few hours. And so there's a lot of very erratic behavior. There's whole articles on all the pathological behavior patterns of GRS 1915, which are completely. My understanding is they just have no idea how to understand. I think these funny things are not unusual. There are many things that are seen that are not understood. So the pipe dream is that maybe we can understand something using this approach.
But the jets are due to stuff matter falling on the black hole, accretion. Right. So
but the accretion disk, you see, the accretion disk comes into the near horizon region, so it is an excitation of the near horizon region, and is part of this conformal field theory.
But do you expect is the matter a part of it?
Yes. It's an excitation of the conformal field theory. It's some operator.
It's a conformal field theory with C.
I got it.
10 to the 76 or something.
Didn't tell us much about the normal density. You didn't tell us about the primary fields.
I'm not telling you. I didn't compute the periodic table first, okay? I only used general principles, and from general principles, we got exactly as much as we would hope to have get. We got the universal behavior. And we know that the Kerr black hole in any theory, it doesn't matter how many species of neutrinos there are or anything, has this entropy. Now, if you want to go further, I can't tell you what the conformal field theory is. If I told you what the conformal field theory is, it would be tantamount to knowing the ultraviolet completion exactly of all the laws of nature. So it's kind of the opposite of the way we're... So, but on the other hand, in this case, you can measure the conformal field theory. So for every field in the standard model, there's also, I mean, I haven't gone into this, but there's also a dictionary. For every field in the standard model, this conformal field theory has an operator of a certain dimension and the standard model gives you the operator content of this conformal field theory, and it's really some rewriting of everything we know about physics in this region. Well, so for example, in ADS5, if you have a field of mass m, it corresponds. A field of mass m corresponds to, well, I remember the formula for ADS3. A field of mass m corresponds means that there's a primary of rate a half plus a half square root of 1 plus 4m squared, okay? So now, and then that formula gets modified for fields with spin. So for every field of some spin, there's some corresponding operator in this conformal field theory with some dimension.
What's the field in the standard model?
Well, David, there's three quarks. There's gluons. Right. We know the we'll know the operators of low dimension. Yeah.
Or
that's presumably what's applicable to the actual physics near the horizon.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, because you'll have to go to very high energies. Yeah.
Certainly, the excitations corresponding to the accretion disk going in will be describable by now.
Actually, if you look at this formula, I sort of got onto this because I was. Part of the way I got onto this is I was on a thesis committee for one of the greatest students on this project, and somehow there's a formula for the accretion disk and for the energy rate, and it seems to involve one less parameter than you would expect. It's kind of universal formula, and I think that is essentially a result of conformal invariance. And by the way, there's an incredible literature on Kerr. I mean, Chandrasekhar has a third of a book on it, and there's all sorts of interesting structure in there. And we're hopeful that this will help tie things together. Well, you know, all this followed from, you know, all this followed just from general relativity. So everything that you could derive from this could be derived from general relativity. But there might be things, you know, to take sort of the opposite thing, like this the Rick story. You know, these long-lived jets at Rick, in principle, you could have gotten it just from numerical simulations of QCD, but you never, you know, the holographic version of that wasn't anything new. It wasn't new physics. It was new computational methods. It was a new way of organizing the thing. So there's not going to be anything unless there's some process in which quantum effects become important, which I doubt. There's not going to be anything that you couldn't calculate some other way. But there might be phenomena which are much better understood in this way. And indeed, I mean, it's, you know, in physics and, you know, in condensed matter systems, we're used to systems where you take some kind of scaling limit and it simplifies and there's some lower dimensional effect of description. And, you know, that's exactly what's going on here. You know, you just look at that picture that I showed in the beginning. There's some dramatic simplification of physics as you get to the horizon of the Kerr, and all excitations are forced to move around the Kerr black hole at the speed of light. Maybe I didn't say that, but you know that there's this thing that Kerr has an ergosphere, right? So if you're way outside of a Kerr black hole and you want to stay at the same angle, you have to actually sort of walk counter to the. Then when you get to the, and you have to walk faster and faster as you approach it. And then when you get to the ergosphere, which is well outside the horizon, you have to go at the speed of light at the boundary of the ergosphere just to stay in the same place. Then if you're inside the ergosphere, you gotta go around. If it's extreme Kerr, you get to the horizon, you gotta go around at the speed of light. So all the physics near the horizon is described by excitations which are part, you know, they're like a chiral half of a two-dimensional field theory, which is moving around the black hole at the speed of light.
Yeah, so you said several times that you think that real astrophysical phenomena associated with the accretion disks might be modeled by this near horizon geometry. And I'm a little surprised. Strictly speaking, of course, this came by zooming in, blowing up the region near the horizon, so that any finite value of R here is sort of infinitesimally close to the horizon in the original Kerr metric. A part of the accretion disks at R equal to, you've thrown away the asymptotically flat region. So anything like at R equal to 2m, I would have thought was way, way outside the reach of this thing. Because anything which knows anything about the asymptotic.
But the edge of the ISCO is way inside R equals 2m. The ISCO is at R equals m when it's extreme.
But the physics of the accretion disk is not going to be just on the last orbit. Right? You're going to need, at least half an m.
So roughly speaking, when R minus m is m over 3, then corrections should be down by a third or something. Corrections to this picture should be down by a third. Now, it's a question of what you're computing, what exactly the expansion parameter is, right? So, for some things, the expansion parameter, it could be J over M squared. And J, or 1 minus J over M squared, which is 0.02, which is a very nice small expansion parameter. So for some things you would try to compute, the corrections might be as small as 2%, but for some other things they could be bigger.
There's a lot of things with square roots of that, though, aren't there?
There's a lot of things with square roots of that in it, right. So that's sort of going against us. There's some cases in which,
So that's like 14% or something, I guess.
Stephen
Chandrasekhar, he discovered by explicit calculation various funny numerical coincidences between scattering of different spin particles off of regular Kerr black holes, not necessarily extremal, and nobody was ever, as far as I know, was ever able to explain these in terms of some sort of symmetry, right, of geometry was revealed then. You think you might be able to...
That's exactly the kind of thing that I would hope we could... we could understand.
He used to ask me that.
That wasn't Preston Kolkowski, that was Chandrasekhar?
Well, I associated the identification of these symmetry. Well, I guess the real way to say it, Chandra used to bug me about these.
Well, there are all kinds of mysterious...
I think one of the things that Chandra showed, I mean, this was certainly later in his book, if you send in a gravitational wave to a charged Kerr black hole, right?
Yeah.
You send in a gravitational wave, you get a certain amount of electromagnetic radiation out.
Right.
And it turns out that the amount you get out is just the same as if you had started off sending an electromagnetic wave and asked how much gravitational radiation.
That kind of thing.
That sort of thing. So the amount sort of switches and just you get the same amount of gravitational wave out sending an electromagnetic wave.
Something with neutrinos also
generalized to Kerr Newman.
We generalized it to Kerr Newman and it works. And it's much more non-trivial.
Anyway, you might take a look. It's not exactly near horizon scattering.
Am I calling on people? I guess so.
Should we applaud?
I mean, you have a 2D CFC describing the four-dimensional thing,
well, I don't think it's very different than what happens to the S5 and ADS5 cross S5. It's just the important thing is the asymptotic symmetry group.
The slightly funny thing is that you're keeping the theta, which is also not getting big, right? The theta is, you're keeping the phi. And the phi direction is not getting big. So it's like you're keeping part of the S5, but not keeping all of the S5.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, there's a comment out there in the five positions.
But by the way, there's also the problem of understanding physics on warped ADS3 is sort of a baby version of Kerr, you know? It's just like, let's forget about theta, and there's lots of systems that have warped ADS3 as solutions, and we can try to understand them. And it's pretty clear that it's not, the conformal structure does not seem to be the right, you know, it's not quite the right asymptotic concept, because there aren't two copies of the conformal group. And so exactly how you're supposed to think about infinity. So, I mean, they're very simple questions, like, you know, I don't even understand how you set up the Cauchy problem in warped ADS3, with whether they're good boundary, you know. There's a lot that isn't understood. Probably the state of the art is those two cryptic paragraphs in your paper with Jim Bardeen about scalars going off to infinity and getting stuck there and not reaching the boundary. I'm not sure what.
We've actually been talking a little bit about that.
I don't think there's much more been done beyond that. There was one or two other, one wrong paper. You know. Yeah.
So if you try to play a game of this form inside the horizon, do you get an algebra that tells you stuff about ring singularities and closed time-like curves and strange things like that?
Well, first of all, I should say that if we draw the Penrose diagram, you can think of this factor here. I assume we clap the talk's over, everybody can leave, right? So I don't have to hurry, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So nobody will offend me if they leave. So if you look at this metric, this is the ADS2 metric here. Or it's a patch of the ADS2 metric. So we can think of this as a kind of swash is the wrong a deformed two-sphere with the circle of the sphere fibered over the ADS2. So if I think of this as the two boundaries of ADS2, the imprint, so when I take the complete extension of this geometry, the imprint of the horizon is this region here. And lines of constant T are doing this. So I am partially inside the horizon. In other words, it's a scaling region which is a narrow ribbon that goes along
You're near
horizons. What?
You're near horizon, but on both sides.
It was on both sides, yeah.
Okay.
Well, this is only on one side, but when I take the extension of that to the complete, I don't know if I said this, but we call this the neck geometry for near horizon extreme curve. We were thinking of calling it BH for Bardeen-Horowitz, but there's black hole Bekenstein-Hawking. So that is just covering this region. But if we take the completion, the geodesic completion, we get something like this, which goes inside the geometry.
Does that see any close?
What? There's no close on my curve. It doesn't go into that region. But as far as other regions, like the ring singularity, you know, people have tried in less exotic geometries in string theory to try to understand these things, and there's really never been any method to get at that.
So, let's clap one more time.